Shakespeare's plays are often accepted as works of historical fact.
I'm sorry, I had to laugh.
I haven't even introduced you yet, but wasn't that great? In the case of Richard III, however, many believe we've been deceived over the past 400 years. Richard III is the current offering of the Atlanta Shakespeare Company. We're joined by the director, whom you've already heard, Jeff Watkins, and the king himself, Andrew Houchins. Welcome to City Lights.
Thank you, Lois. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes. Well,
thank you for coming in. So the full title, as it was published first in Shakespeare's time, is, am I correct, isn't that the first quarto? Is that what the quarto is?
I believe so.
Okay. This full title summarizes the play, The Tragedy of King Richard III, containing his treacherous plots against his brother Clarence, the pitiful murder of his innocent nephews, his tyrannical usurpation, with the whole course of this detested life and most deserved death. Not a nice guy.
Not so much.
Not terribly kind, no.
Well, so how much historical accuracy is there in Shakespeare's Richard III, and does it even matter?
It doesn't matter. And I would have to say, just always remember that history is written by the winners, and it was in the interest of the Tudors to make Richard III the most detestable man imaginable. So I don't really believe there's a lot of fact there. Andy, of course, is playing the part.
I tend to try to avoid, even with a play that is called a history as opposed to a tragedy as this one is, the history of it matters less to me, actually, than what Shakespeare wrote. It was, in certain senses, a sort of propaganda, but I consider it the difference between trying to do a documentary versus a picture or something that is based on the life of, or a story inspired by the events of, where there are always some liberties taken with the story, with some of the timelines and the characterizations of them. I tend to focus, especially with a play like this one, where there are some questions about how accurate it is to the Richard that actually existed. I don't bother myself too much with that because it might conflict, and the literal part of my mind wants things to line up a little too closely, and then I wind up trying to justify things in a different way. So I take what's in the script, what the text is in front of me, and go with that.
I remember when Peter Schaffer's play Amadeus first came out, and not too long after the movie, there were musicians who were just totally freaked out because it was not biographically accurate. And Schaffer never said he was creating a biopic or biographical play. He used dramatic license to tell a story with themes he thought even broader than Mozart's story. But many people who saw the play and the film nonetheless took it as such. There is a danger in accepting a biopic, or in this case, something that's endured over 400 years, a great play, as historically accurate. But sometimes it's a jumping off point for people.
It certainly creates a situation where people are talking about it.
Yeah.
You talk about Richard III, or you become interested in Mozart, or you'll start to look up what we think are the facts, and you'll look at different stories, and I think that's always a good thing.
So, Jeff, when you said, this play, Richard III, history is told by winners, I think you may be referring to the Tudor myth?
Yes.
What is the Tudor myth, and how does it relate to Richard III.
Well, if Richard had won at the Battle of Bosworth, I'm sure the story would have been told entirely differently. Actually, there's a historical novel, I think Sharon K. Penman wrote The Sun in Splendor, which takes a lot of the historical facts and constructs a timeline and character relationships that actually are far more believable and grounded in human behavior as we know it. And in that book, Richard is actually a hero in his own way, and his great failing is that he did not execute his enemies, and they continued to come back on him, and then ultimately they killed him and then defamed him. But it's a very interesting book. It's a whole different thing. It's I can't remember. There's another one. It's about a police detective who's recovering, and he starts to do the A Daughter of Time. He starts to do a forensic analysis and comes to the conclusion that Richard III actually is not was not a villain. But the Tudors had a vested interest in legitimizing their reign. And actually, in all of Shakespeare's history plays, they affirm the current social order. We think of the Elizabethan times as actually somewhat enlightened, but it was actually, you know, aside from the fact that Elizabeth chose not to engage in religious persecution, it was a pretty buttoned-up society.
Wait a minute. Wouldn't beheading her cousin, who was Catholic, be maybe engaging in some religious persecution?
Well, I think she was beheaded not for being Catholic, but because she was rebelling and willing to lead a revolt in the name of Catholicism. She was caught plotting and then had to be, well, I mean, it caused her great pain. Of course, she wasn't comfortable. That's a good play, too. I should be doing that next year. But in terms of what had come before, Sir Thomas More, for example, we think of him as this, you know, marvelous man. Of course, he was, and he was brilliant. But he burned a lot of people for heresy at the stake. And people were dying for their religious beliefs. And Elizabeth kind of put a stop to that. She said, if you're a Catholic, that's not the official religion. You know, what you do in your own home is one thing. You come to church, you know, you pay your taxes and just don't talk about it so much. We'll just let it go. She was considerably more tolerant in that regard than the people who had come before her. But it was a very buttoned-up society. I've heard it described as a fascist society. I wouldn't go that far. But everything had to go through the censor, and everything had to affirm the social order. And in many ways, the history plays are instructional to the English people. This is how you behave. And if you do your duty, what will happen is you will get to continue in this marvelous realm that is ruled by Elizabeth, who is a gift from God. And if you don't behave like these people in Henry VI, what you wind up with is Richard III. So it's a cautionary tale as much as anything else. But
indeed. Some of Shakespeare's most famous lines open the first scene soliloquy. Andy, would you recite those opening lines?
Yes. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York, and all the clouds that lowered upon our house to the deep bosom of the ocean bury it. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths, our bruised arms hung up for monuments, our stern alarums changed to merry meetings, our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war hath smoothed his wrinkled front, and now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fright the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute. But I, that am not shaped for sportive tricks, nor made to court an amorous looking-glass, I, that am rudely stamped, and want love's majesty to strut before a wanton ambling nymph, I that am curtailed of this fair proportion, cheated of feature by dissembling nature, deformed, unfinished, sent before my time into this breathing world scarce half made up, and that so lamely and unfashionable that dogs bark at me as I halt by them. Why, I, in this weak and piping time of peace, have no delight to pass away the time, unless to spy my shadow in the sun, and descant on mine own deformity, and therefore, since I cannot prove a lover, and entertain these fair well-spoken days, I am determined to prove a villain, and hate the idle pleasures of these days.
Bravo.
Thank you.
Now, because the language is so gorgeous and the metaphor so rich, I think there may be a tendency to let those gorgeous lines just pour over us like a wonderful shower, like standing beneath one of those great big wonderful shower heads. What would you recommend for people who don't know much about Shakespeare or Elizabethan English to come and appreciate the play? How can you attract a larger or wider audience when their perception may be that the language itself is challenging?
I think a large part of it, what helps with us is the fact that we have the style of speaking directly to the audience. There's a lot to be said for, with a fourth wall take on Shakespeare, and two characters are speaking to each other. It doesn't process over an audience's ears quite as easily. It's easier to maybe check out or lose sight of the picture of what's happening. With our direct audience address, that approach, that sort of style, that original practice that we believe, we imagine Shakespeare's companies themselves used, we're able to give story directly to the audience, similarly to what Jeff was saying, that instructional way of being. It's very clear, look, you need to know this is who my brother is. You need to know that the king currently is also my brother. You need to know that I'm sort of pitting them against each other so that way I can sneak in the way that I need to in order to make things happen the way I want them to happen. The fact that I'm speaking those words directly to you seems to allow people, an audience, to process that information more easily because it's coming right at them, okay, for lack of a better term.
And Jeff?
I was going to say we serve beer. and actually, that's funny in and of itself, but we do invite our audience to come spend time with us before the show, to break bread, to have a glass of wine or a beer, or to sit and to relax and to be fully present in the moment when the show starts. It's very, very different than if you're hurrying to get to the theater. You know the show starts at 8. You know, you're pulling into the parking lot at 4 minutes until 8, and you go tearing through there, and then you come, boom, and then the lights go down, and then the play starts to happen. I mean, with us, we want to get you in there 20, 30, 40 minutes before that so you can relax and become acclimated, and then the show begins, then we start talking directly to you. It's so much easier to understand complex language or anything anyone is saying to you if you have access to their eyes. And in the Elizabethan theater, as we imagine it and as we play it, there's no pretense at all. We're not giving you reality any more than you go to the Nutcracker to see the way people really walk. We're storytellers, and we're there to tell a story.
Great, great analogy there. If you're just joining us, I'm Lois Reitzes, and this is City Lights. Our guests are director Jeff Watkins and actor Andy Houchins, who plays King Richard III in the Atlanta Shakespeare Company's new production. We'll be back after a short break.
Support for WABE comes from Nissan of Noonan. Nissan of Noonan, a fresh approach to the car buying experience. Their number is 844-FRESH-15, online at nissanofnoonan.com. And from Live Nation, welcoming Lindsey Buckingham and Christine McVie to Chastain Park Amphitheater for one night only this Wednesday night. Tickets are available now at Ticketmaster.com.
I like the colors.
So, This is City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. We're back with director Jeff Watkins and actor Andy Houchins, currently playing the role of Richard III at the Atlanta Shakespeare Tavern. So Richard has to dispose of six people between him and the throne. Six people. When his dying brother, Edward IV, has gone. And when he takes the crown, he's actually removed only one of them. The others he'll deal with later. Frank Underwood from House of Cards comes to mind here. I mean, vividly. Andy, were you drawing upon any other villains when you crafted your portrayal?
It's funny that I'm not sure exactly what it is that directors see in me. The villainous type at the tavern does seem to be kind of my wheelhouse.
And you're such a sweetie. What is that, Jeff? What, you know?
I admire his ability to speak text incredibly clearly and rapidly.
Ah.
So Iago and Richard III, they both talk a lot. And it's a virtue when you have somebody who can be that impassioned, that clear, and that fast.
And as such effective mean guys.
Yeah, there's there wasn't anything specific that I drew from other than imagination of what would take it. What would it take to drive a person to this level, to get this deep? One of the things that I mentioned at one of our Q&As last night was, to a certain level, there's very little difference between, at least on an emotional level, killing somebody physically and killing somebody emotionally or killing somebody mentally. It's all a matter of degrees, really. So just imagining an expansion of one of the simpler ones is not too terrible.
Okay.
And that moral outlook is also an asset to an actor.
And to the character of Frank Underwood. I'm still working through him. I've read that the revered Shakespearean actor of the last century, Laurence Olivier, portrayed Richard as pure evil, and some of the defenders, those people in the Richard III society, which exists, even fault Olivier for perpetuating Richard's villainous reputation. What do you think of that?
Well, I will say that it is fun to play pure evil, but it's, you know, it's like a TV show like 24. I mean, you know, there are plot devices, and it's nice to look in a story and say, well, that's what evil looks like. This is what good looks like. I'm on the good side. I'm not on the evil side. But, you know, life is a lot grayer than that. We all have a mixture of these things, and, you know, stories and myths tend to clarify our stance, and we try to use those as reference points in our real life, but it's so easy to get confused. So I would say that, you know, these villains that are just so vivid, you know, they give us a security and a clarity that we don't get in real life. So I think they're attractive. And they also are great for storytelling.
Yes. And, okay, then, if we read up on the history, we may also learn not entirely a villain. Although, you know, that line about Mussolini making the trains run on time also comes to mind. I mean, I read it. It was so much fun prepping for this. I just fell down such a rabbit hole. I read some historian said, actually, Richard III was a very fine administrator. And I thought, okay, that's not the highest form of compliment.
No. But people are multi-layered. I mean, no one's pure evil, and, you know, few people are pure good, you know, so it's, we all have our failings.
It comes back, it's always what gets a person to that point. What drives a person? We can look back now and acknowledge how a person's upbringing, if there is negligence, some psychological damage that can happen at a young age, can continue to influence how that person develops as they get older. It's interesting to me that this character, Richard, showing up in three different plays, Henry VI Part 2, Henry VI Part 3, and then this one, the first time we ever see his mother, the first thing he does is drop to his knee and plead for a blessing. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit begrudging, and there's clearly some, for lack of a better term, in the arc that I've been following with this character, there's definitely some mommy issues there.
back to the Greeks, you know, as always.
Absolutely. It keeps coming back for me to what happened at this young age, the idea of being this physically deformed person and not having any kind of sensitivity to it that we might have today. Everybody, even family members, calling him names, people that he cares about, referring to him, not just villains, but or enemies, you know, Hedgehog and people that he's known for long times.
Because he was deformed.
Because of a physical deformity, something that he had no ability to control.
Yeah. Last month, Actors Express put on a marvelous production here in Atlanta of a play by Susan Laurie Parks, Father Comes Home from the Wars. And we had the director and lead actor on City Lights as guests. The action takes place during the American Civil War, and the playwright draws largely, in fact, you could almost call it a retelling of the Odyssey. So classical Greek drama and 3 hours long. And I asked the director of that production why he thought people would be up for a long evening at the theater with such serious subject matter. And now I ask the same of you.
I think a lot of people simply sell their audience short. This is a lot of play. There's no two ways about it. We sold out every performance this week. And I was, of course, enormously gratified. We did all three parts of Henry VI. And, of course, this is the capper. So I could make this play 25 minutes shorter by taking out all the references to Henry VI. But I have a lot of people who are invested in this, and they want to see the whole thing. You know, because I jokingly say to the actors, you know, if it's good enough, it can never be long enough. I would say, and this is in all honesty, because I do watch out for this, on four nights in this opening week, we sold out all four shows, two people left.
Well, the director from Father Comes Home from the Wars had a very contemporary take. He said, we live in an age of binge viewing. And he said, if storytelling is compelling enough, the time flies by.
That is actually the binge watching idea, is what Jeff says in the house speech for our show every night, making sure that everyone acknowledges that, yes, this seems like a 3 hour play, but if you view it as, you know, three episodes of Game of Thrones,
literally.
Very much so, yeah. Yes.
And we do have two intermissions, so it is. It's 60 minutes, 55, and 60 minutes.
And they so, did as well. And the hero of all endures storytelling. Jeff Watkins is the artistic director of the Atlanta Shakespeare Company. He directs the current production of Richard III, in which Andrew Houchins plays King Richard. The show runs through July 2nd. Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you for having us.